This podcast is made possible by the kind donations of listeners. To see how you can support the show, go to patreon.com/WW2podcast. Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. In this episode, I'm talking to Edward Hooton and we're looking at the air war over the Eastern Front, a topic I'm not that familiar with, and from my own point of view, it's always been overshadowed by the war on the ground. Edward has written a number of books on aviation history during the Second World War, and his latest book, The War Over the Steppes, The Air Campaigns on the Eastern Front, 1941-45, is a fascinating look at the air operations carried out by both the Russians and the Germans during the war. Edward, thanks for joining me. I wonder if you'd start before the war with the purges. Presumably, the Air Force would have been hit hard. It's staffed by the intelligentsia, as it were, and not the illiterate.
I question, actually, whether the purges wasn't the excuse, ready-made excuse for the Soviet armed forces for their defeat. One of the things that the people who were wet were removed, most of them weren't properly trained staff officers. And the people who came up, through Shapishnikov's reforms from 38, when he established a staff college, these were people like not Zhukov, but many of the big staff members who turned up and helped the Soviet Union win the war. But the thing about the purges is that just as the Stukas are coming in dropping bombs, NKVD blokes are running through past the bomb craters trying to catch new people because they'd started a complete purge of the Soviet Air Force. It kicked off around April of 41. And it was done by Zhukov and Timoshenko. Like they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And they weren't happy about the Soviet Air Force commander also training accidents. They weren't aware of the fact that the Soviet Air Training Organization was total crap and was even crappier during the war. Look at it this way. How many hours do you think that, an average pilot, British American pilot, had 300 hours, 400 hours before he actually went for operational training? Guys were going from the schools to reserve units with 4 hours training. Basically enough to get up, fly around the airfield, get it down safely. Oh, you've got that. Well done, comrade. You're a pilot. Here's your chicken. That's the absolute truth. And every time that these poor buggers got chopped time after time in the offensives, they had to be replaced by other people who had barely any training on gunnery. So the units who were knackered after a campaign, they were having to train these. They had to send their slave traders to get the new recruits and bring them back and then train these poor sobs up. And this was the problem. This was not just the purges. The purges had an effect. I mean, basically, almost the entire frontline command leadership of the Soviet Air Force in 1941, at the time the Germans invaded, was purged. The PVO, the long-range aviation, they were all purged. Actually, PVO, the Air Defense Organization, was purged because of a Lufthansa airliner. This plane landed, and somebody was checking the paper. There's no paperwork. Why is this? Sort of somebody goes legging it over to Stalin. Oh, Joseph Ivanov, Vasilyevich, look at these nasty. And anyway, the result was they get purged.
Does that just make them massively inefficient at the start of the war? I mean, do they have to?
Yes, it does. I mean, those who didn't shoot themselves and those who managed to avoid the NKVD death squads were scared like nobody's business, because the slightest mistake, you didn't upset comrade Stalin. In fact, it was the reason Zhigarev, who held he's the real, in many respects, the hero, the unsung hero of the Soviet air power, because he kept the Soviet Air Force together in the first months of the war. There was a big row and he went to the Far East. Novikov replaced him. And yet, as Novikov, after the war, Novikov's career went zonk, and Zhigarev's went zonk. In fact, if you ever fly from London to Moscow, it's because of the agreement that Zhigarev signed. One of the last things he did in 59.
Where were the Russians drawing their recruits from? You see, over the Allies, you upper middle class sort of backgrounds?
The recruits were drawn from volunteers, usually reasonably educated volunteers. Middle class, no, because anybody could go through a Soviet paramilitary organization. So you could learn to fly on that. And if you wanted, you could develop. This organization sort of had brought in pilots before the war, and afterwards they were recruiting pretty well anybody they could get their hands on who was capable of reading the manuals, taking off, landing, and knowing something about having some intelligence. There were very few people from the Soviet Far East. The Soviet Union always treated them as second-class citizens, but there were one or two who were in the Air Force and were senior airmen and air racers.
How did that compare to the Germans? Because presumably the German pilots had a much more, as you say, like the Allies, 300 hours. They must have had a regimented training regime.
They had a much better training and more demanding training regime. It was, first of all, get the plane up, ground down. Basic training. Then it was advanced training. Then it was combat training. And then they went to a reserve unit where they'd be polished up, and then they'd go to the frontline unit. The point about the two sets of airmen is that you find that the Germans are flying on the Eastern Front, flying far more sorties and shooting down far more aircraft. You know, the ACEs shot down far more aircraft than their Russian equivalent. And in part, this reflected the two systems. The Russian system was more collective. They did not like, they praised air races, but you know, you thought collectively or you got into trouble. There were cases of one or two Soviet fighter pilots who actually started the war and survived to the end of it, still in the front. And yet they did far fewer sorties than the Germans. And it appears to have been, especially during offensives, once the Soviet army was sort of pushing deep into German-held territory, the supply situation began to go down, and that meant that it was more difficult to fly sorties. And with regard to the Germans, especially the fighter pilots, basically the guard dog, the Rottenhund, his job was to keep opposition off the ACEs back, and the ACEs was just to shoot down as many planes as possible, and they were encouraged to do so.
I'd never realised that. It's a fabulous system. Did anyone else, so you've got your ace and he's almost his wingman, haven't you, as he hunts them down. Did anyone else use that system? Did the British ever cotton on to it, or the Americans? Or
the Russians and the Germans, basically, their airmen fought on until literally they dropped. I mean, in Rudel's case, he was flying with half a leg. And he probably flew more sorties, 2,500, I think, than anybody else on the Eastern Front. But the British and Americans, they had this tour system, X number of operational sorties, full operational sorties, then they pulled them out. This meant that you had a pool of reserve people who then passed their experience on to recruits, incorporated into staff and training, and that made the whole Air Force, improve the whole quality of the Air Force. Germans, Russians never had that. Literally fought to their drop, poor buggers.
And I noticed in the statistics in the book, there seems an astronomical high rate of accidents. Presumably that's behind it.
Oh yes, that's part of that is part of it. I mean, with the Russians, you have, as I say, you have these poor sods who are barely capable of getting the plane into the air and down again, and they're landing on often bad airfields. The Germans, to some degree, the same. And you find this, as I say, that the conditions are bad, but the Russian casualties, especially to accidents, seem to have been far heavier than German. But the Germans were still pretty bad because of the conditions they were flying in.
Yeah, I make a note? I was staggered how high they were. The Russians had commissars attached to their units as well. I mean, that must have...
Every damn one. Every unit. The attitude to the commissar, there was always worry. You watched your tongue anywhere near the commissar. In fact, you watched your tongue full stop. They were very influential. But the attitude depended upon whether the commissar flew or didn't fly. If he flew and was in action, not instead of standing on the airfield saying, "Go, comrade, for the glory of the Soviet motherland," they were regarded as crap. One bloke was told a fighter pilot was told to take his plane in. Plane wasn't serviceable or something. And he said, "F*** you. If you want to fly, you take it up." And this took a bit of bravery. But as I say, one of the things, there's a website called I Remember Russian. And it is interviews, not just with air crew, but all sorts of Soviet men. And it is fascinating, the information that comes out of them. It really is. The attitude. I mean, to some degree, there's repetition. But there's also lots of information about how they behaved, how they lived, what they thought. And some of these guys had literally lived through the Ukrainian famine.
Well, you kind of have to frame... It's like looking at the First War. You sort of have to frame the atrocious experience that you believe they're having now with possibly what they had before, which probably wasn't, you know, which might make it actually not as atrocious as we might think now when we look back.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Well, I
quote a case of a transport pilot captured by the British, and of course they're recording, and this guy's talking about how... He was on the Eastern Front, met up with a mate from the SS, and they had a lot, really fun time hunting down Jews. And then this Jewish girl, trying to save her own life, agreed to sleep with him. So he had his evil way with her, left her, and watched her being marched off to her death. On the other side, you have a case, again, this is from the I Remember, of a Jewish pilot who'd lost his family to the Nazis. A German pilot landed nearby. He was captured. And this pilot was given permission by his regimental commander to take this fellow for a ride. And I mean, bang, for a ride. And there were frequent murders of air crew on the Eastern Front. Russian air crew were put into so-called medical experiments, which involved them dying in quite revolting ways.
I was more sort of thinking the conditions that the crews suffered in the field. At least they're getting, you know, they are getting fed regularly, although the Russians... undoubtedly were problematic. That might well have been better what they had pre-war, and you know, the troops on their own sides and things.
I mean, bear in mind that it's very unlikely that most Soviet aircraft people working in the aircraft industry throughout the war probably never saw an egg or even powder egg. The guys in the front, the Russians, there were two levels of rations, one for air crew, one for ground crew. And there was a third level of rations for the guys who were bringing up all the supplies, which was lower than the ground crews. And these poor buggers were starving.
Well, I have to say that you state the calories in the book, and I don't think I made a note of them. And I was quite, they are on the edge of what you should be eating for manual labour.
Exactly. And the civilians were getting less.
Had the Russians had obviously been bloodied before the war at Finland in Spain. Were they aware of their deficiencies?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. Yes, I was aware of the limitation, especially with regard to flying hours. Even before the war, flying hours were pretty low, literally little more than circuits and bumps. Formation flying, gunnery training, these were rarities. I don't know why, whether it was to save material or because the commanders were afraid of accidents, which would reflect badly, you know, and attract the attention of agents of state security who would like to have a quiet discussion with you about 3 o'clock in the morning, perhaps.
It's curious because the Germans certainly came out of it, you know, out of Spain with certain ideas. I think it's more reaffirmed, actually, what they were doing or the direction they were going rather than anything else. It's curious that the Russians hadn't drawn similar conclusions, especially as Finland was, you know, very problematic.
It was a total disaster. About half the Soviet air ground casualties were sustained by in the Arctic Circle against almost nominal Finnish forces. The same with the Air Force. The figures I quote, whenever I quote figures for losses, I quote figures from the source, Russian figures from Russian sources, German figures, German sources. And yes, it was a total disaster. But you had a series of changes of command, partly the purges, partly they were trying to kick people upstairs to try and improve the command. The guy they had by the beginning of the second, by the time of Barbarossa, he was exactly like Udet. He was a fighter pilot, good fighter pilot. But... it was a job which required you sitting behind a desk, giving orders, devolving work, and this guy couldn't hack it.
Just before we get on to combat, did they both have the German Air Force and the Russian Air Force? doctrinally, were they sort of coming from a similar... I got the feeling they're sort of coming from a similar idea.
Yes.
They either believed in heavy bombing, you know, that was much more of an extension of a...
They believed in what is... Funnily enough, they have a term. They had a unique term, the Germans and the Russians, operative, which means literally operational. And the Air Force was to support the forces at the operational level. And operational means roughly between army and army group. Tactical is operations up to army level. Above army group is strategic. Both actually did believe in long-range aviation, long-range bombing, but as a feature of operational, not a separate campaign. It's a subtle difference. The Germans always believed in strategic bombing, but their priority was to support the armed forces, the army, and to a lesser degree, the navy.
I thought, because that was something else I think is very interesting. It's almost like people always say, you know, the Germans never sort of, Hitler never kind of got, he was obsessed with how land was, and using your air force in that way is kind of an extension of the army, whereas Britain used to extend its power. I wonder if it's an argument to say strategic bombing is something that we're more used to because we're projecting power with our navy. It was also the only way we could hit back, so that's probably another reason why we were...
That's absolutely true. It's also true that the Royal Air Force, which was strategic bombing was its raison d'être, it was less prepared for a strategic bombing campaign than the Germans at the beginning of the Second World War. I mentioned that in some of my earlier Luftwaffe books, the Phoenix Triumphant, which goes into some detail. There were no electronic navigation aids. In fact, the pilot was supposed to fly the plane and read a map on his kneecap. That's true. There were no dedicated navigators. The bombs were too small. The planes were too short-ranged. It was a shambles.
I presumed that we'd kind of... Cause We've got our heavy bombers online when needed, relatively fast.
They were under development. Interestingly, two of the new bombers for Bomber Command, the Halifax and the Manchester, which they became, were both designed for dive bombing.
Oh, were they?
Oh yeah. There was specific. It never specified the angle, although somebody did suggest. I've learned through requirements documents. Another book who suggested this, and then I followed it up. And at one point, they're suggesting a 70-degree dive angle in a Halifax. But I think actually this is the reason why when Lancasters faced German fighters, they'd do this tight corkscrew. The reason they could throw the plane around was because the structure had been designed to take the stresses of dive bombing.
That's incredible. I hadn't realised that.
There's loads of stuff there.
Yeah, it keeps turning up and falls out. so the opening of the campaign is essentially a disaster for Russia. We're talking about thousands of planes in the first, but 5,000 planes in the first month. Why was it? Why is there such a huge disparity in losses?
Well, first of all, when the Germans' planes first flew over as dawn was breaking on the 22nd of June, most of the Russian aircraft were lined up, a bit like the Americans at Pearl Harbor, and for a similar reason. And you had these planes lined up. Not only that, there were very few airfields. Not only that, but the bureaucrats at the Defence Ministry or the War Ministry, sorry, Defence Ministry, had decided that to make sure that their air force had modern aircraft, many of the regiments had received their consignment of brand new aircraft, which were also lined up. So, you've doubled the targets. Few airfields, overcrowded. Totally unprotected, virtually no anti-aircraft guns, no camouflage netting, no revetments. It's like shooting fish in a barrel. The only thing the Germans didn't get was the aircrew. Most of the aircrew survived. Mind you, for how long is it difficult to say.
Well, I was going to say that might at least in the short term mean when you can get more aircraft back online, you've got someone to fly it. And with such huge advances, presumably that puts the aircraft production under threat as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah, basically almost all of the production facilities had to be sent east of Moscow. many down to the Urals. And this totally disrupted the production process, which never really caught up. At the same time, the Soviet production was, it was dynamic in that they produced loads of aircraft, in many cases more than their allies, more than the enemies, and sometimes the British. But they had to focus on a handful of types. And these were often made with timber, because there was very little aluminium alloy production, by semi-skilled men, because they took the factories, they didn't take the people with them quite often. So you have semi-skilled people, men, women, children, volunteers eager, no quality control. And that's what killed Pateliakov. Somebody left a rag in the engine, caught fire, and vroomt. And you know, sometimes these planes, it was difficult to get them to put the bits together. These were the problems that they were facing, getting new aircraft. Around the time, but during the second half of 42, there were literally hundreds of Soviet regiments, air regiments, in the rear, roughly in the Urals and in that area, which were just nominally there, a small cadre, maybe one main training aircraft, because they couldn't get replacement aircraft and they couldn't get replacement crews. And this was at the time it was coming up for Stalingrad.
I hadn't realised it got that desperate, because the numbers involved on both sides seemed to me, aircraft-wise, to be astronomical.
Yeah, in many respects they were, but you have to remember the Russian aircraft, one, they had only high-frequency radios, shorts, which are subject to interference. That's assuming they're put in properly. Short-ranged. The engines, Russian aircraft engines, were not very good. Basically little more than scrap. They leaked like sieves, were often unreliable. They leaked oil like sieves. They had very low octane fuel. The Russians never had high octane fuel. The best they could do was get a barrel of fuel, shove some additives into it, and then stir it up. And that was. But even planes like the Air Cobra and the Hawks, which were so used to 100 octane fuel, had to use this 87 octane fuel, the fuel really suitable more for bombers than for fighters.
Well, you have that incredible story in the book where there's the batch of yaks shed their skin through the wrong paint.
Yeah, exactly. You see, somebody was trying to exceed his production quotas, which, you know, this was a society obsessed with statistics, Soviet society. So you had to produce more. So this guy thought, oh, this will do the job. He hadn't realised the problem. No doubt the agent of state security explained it to him in great detail.
Yes. The Germans struggled with their idea of churning out planes, didn't they, until Speer gets in becomes armaments minister.
Yeah, it's not that, it's also that the German industry wasn't really into mass production. It wandered towards mass production, but it was really more of a craft based in many respects. In fact, all of German war industry was. Speer encouraged better mass production, but of course when he turned up, bomber production was going down. A mate of mine, now dead, he was a bomber, he trained as a bomber pilot, sorry, as a bomber navigator. By the time he qualified, there were no bombers, so he was transferred to a paratroop unit.
And something else you brought out in the book, which I couldn't quite understand, you point out they didn't really focus on producing spares, they just produced whole machines. Surely, you know, when you're running short, if you could keep other machines working, why are they not producing? Why is there not an effective spares backup?
It's not there were no spares. It was to be honest, I don't know the production side, where ordinary industrial production. But you have, I think, say for every one component you produce, say 5-10 spares. The Germans would produce three spares. And the same with the Russians, because spares, you know, that doesn't sound good in the statistics. So, you know, a whole plane, wow, a widget, what the hell? So this was, you know, this was one of the reasons. So there were fewer spares. I mean, by 1945, as the Germans are retreating, they became a throwaway air force. It was easier to throw a plane, a plane couldn't work. Say a tyre was flat. It was easier to get a brand new fighter than to get the parts to replace it. course, if you got the fuel, was more difficult. But you know, it was easy.
That's something that that struck me as quite incredible. When you know production figures are going down, they've got to a level where they could just dispose of them and move on to a new one very quick. Radios, that's what I was thinking of before. You mentioned radios, and you know, how were the Russians in supporting their ground troops? You know, they're coming from the same idea as the Germans, but the Germans have radios left, right and centre in all their vehicles and everything. How do the Russians, when they're supporting their air forces, supporting their ground troops, how does that function? Because they were not as, you know, as technologically as forward, were they?
It's true, their radio industry wasn't as developed as the German. However, they did they had radio-equipped forward observers. The air forces, each air army, would provide teams for that, usually with the at the say tank mechanized corps headquarters, cavalry corps headquarters, army headquarters, and these guys would often have teams far forward, and so they would call down air power as and when. As I say, the big problem was relatively short-range radios, but it worked time after time, especially later, increasingly. The Soviet Ilyusha units would chop German columns to pieces. But the problem was that as the Red Army advanced deeper, fuel supplies got less, so the aircraft couldn't, even though the Ilyusha units would go forward, you know, there was less fuel and less ammunition for them to use, despite all the effort. I mean, they'd fly in stuff, they'd give priority, but, you know, there's limits to what you can do. So the Russian air effort, after X amount of days, say a week or two, would, in terms of sorties, would start to decline quite significantly, and that gave Germans time to recover.
Yeah, that was another point that never occurred to me in the book, that as you advance, the one thing is distance, because you think aircraft can fly for hundreds of miles, but actually the lack of airfields as you advance.
Yeah, I remember the Germans sabotaged them. The Russians got a way of sending in teams in vehicles, on ground vehicles, and start to delouse them with bombs and everything and get them ready. And then they'd bring in a transport aircraft, start setting up, ready for the first units to fly in. I mean, this is one of the things that people don't think of. It's one of the things about my book, is that I've tried to point out, you know, it's not just the guys flying the fighters and the bombers and all the rest of it. It's the industrial support, the production, supply, feeding in supplies. You've also got to look at their long-range bomber forces, their air defence forces, and I mean, even include stuff on special operations, dropping spies and stuff.
Presumably, life on these air bases, when we're talking air bases, we must most of the time presumably talking about not much more than grass strips, prepared grass strips.
Most of them, yeah.
So life on these air bases...
People would walk along stomping down the ice or the snow to make...
During the winter and the spring thaws must have been dreadful.
Oh, yes, that basically stopped, unless you had a concrete airstrip, that basically stopped the air operations in its tracks, especially the Russian ones. They tried to get the airfields running, but, you know, there was very little they could do until the ground dried out, and then they'd have to sort of roller it out.
or thawed hard. Then you probably no doubt got another set of problems with frozen fuel and various other problems.
They didn't seem to have such a problem with it, with the Russians. I think that because their aircraft was supposed to operate in a Russian winter, they were more used to it. They never seemed to have any problems, but it really hacked them off, because the first British Western aircraft, the Kitty Hawks, Hurricanes, which arrived, come the winter, you know, these had the same problems as the Luftwaffe had in the early winter of 1941. But gradually they figured out ways around the problems. But they were less affected by problems like that than the Germans were. And even the Germans, they got used to it and sorted the problems out.
When they received these Lend-Lease planes, did they ever build any under licence? I mean, I'm sure the Russians wouldn't necessarily bother with a licence, just knock them out. But I did find it curious that they weren't building, because we were obviously shipping things.
Yeah, they didn't build them because their own facilities, they were absolutely, their factories were working flat out, so they couldn't take the time to assign new buildings to build new aircraft, foreign aircraft, which they would regard as inferior in any case. Also, these aircraft were technically, their construction alloys, most of metal alloys, which there was very little of. Interestingly enough, there was talk of giving the Russians a license to build the Mosquito, a wooden aircraft, but the Russians couldn't do the balsa wood technology.
Now, were the Russian aircraft, were they superior, or were they just right for them?
It depends. If you mean superior to the German aircraft? Well, to be honest, that's difficult to say. I think that by 43 onwards, the Russian aircraft could hold their own, possibly in some ways superior to German. But I think it was pretty even. Before that, no. The biggest problem the Russians had, as I say, were things like poor cockpit canopies. For example, they tended to yellow up the plastic, so many of them had to fly with the cockpits open, which is not much fun in a Russian winter. Well, that's why a lot of them got frostbite on their cheeks. The engines were unreliable. These were problems. The aircraft themselves were robust, could do the job, but by the end of the Second World War, even the Russians recognised that their air force was basically obsolete compared to the Western air forces. That's one of the reasons they were starting to produce the B-29s. And it's one of the reasons that they were also to familiarise themselves with the new technology. They issued a couple of regiments with captured Liberators and Fortresses, but never used them as far as I can discover. There's no record of it. But somebody might have done, but I've never come across it.
They might not have had the personnel to keep it running, that kind of thing.
Yeah, they had the personnel to keep the planes running. They cannibalised parts. Poltava was a treasure trove of parts, and I have a feeling that they salvaged a few aircraft which the Americans wrote off, because they say that the first aircraft they put into service were fortresses. The only place that could have got the fortresses was at Poltava, and so they were able to fly these aircraft without. Not too much difficulty. They were fascinated by the tricycle undercarriage. They're fascinated by that and in the Air Cobra.
Is there an overemphasis on technology because they just need to create production numbers? They're less interested in coming up with technological advancements such as window and radar and things that the Allies and the British came up with?
Well, the British and the Allies, had quite sophisticated industries at the beginning of the war, unlike the Russians. And also, once the Russians were invaded, basically everything had to go direct into the war effort. There was very little spare capacity, if any. I mean, it's unusual that 1945, I think, late 44, Stalin gave authority for low-level development of what he called the uranium bomb, which was the atom bomb. There was too little too little spare capacity, and casualties were so heavy that basically the Russians had to focus on getting as much as possible to the front, and very little in the way of faffing around or going for exotic technologies.
Yeah, exotic technologies.
Well, radar was an exotic technology. They had their own radars. They took those radars forward, which was a surprise to me. But They had a ground controlled interception from Stalingrad onwards. Biggest problem was the radios, but yes, they had it, and it was fairly effective too.
I wonder if there's a strange mindset with the Russians. They build a T-34 and lots of them, but it's like, we've got that, it works, just make NASA, the same with the aircraft production, and not get confused. Let's not confuse what we're doing. It's almost a blinkered single-mindedness. And we'll just keep building sledgehammers.
Yeah. Well, look at the opposite on the Germans. They virtually got rid of none of their armoured vehicle chassis production. Apart from the Panzer I, they used every one. Instead of getting rid of them and focusing on a few vehicles like the Panzer IV Long, Panther, Tiger, they were producing loads of chassis which were for exotic things like self-propelled anti-tank guns, self-propelled artillery, forward observer vehicles, this sort of thing. And this was how the Russians were able to outproduce them. The Russians also did improve vehicles when needed. I mean, the T-34 got originally a 76mm gun, and then it got an 85mm gun to deal with the beasts. They had a Russian word, and it's usually translated as beast killer, but I've always thought that the term should be beast master. for your T-34, the ISU 122, that sort of ISU 152, that sort of thing.
We touched upon before, we were talking about logistics and transport issues. I mean, there's a temptation always to use your Air Force as a sort of a long distance transport whittling away. How much of a problem was that for both sides?
Well, the Germans had their own transport arm, and it worked fairly effectively. They augmented it with bombers when necessary, but notably at Stalingrad, because half the transport force was in the Mediterranean when the Russians struck at Stalingrad. The Russians, they had transport aircraft. They also used the civil air fleet, and they also had to use the long-range air forces, which included LI-2s. The LI-2s were both as transports, but they also used the LI-2 as a bomber, dedicated bombers. So they would use these aircraft as transports, and quite frequently. There are many examples in which I mentioned in the book.
I sort of got the idea that they were almost pulling away combat aircraft, especially around the time of Stalingrad, where they're just needing to get supplies in, and you're almost losing combat effectiveness on transport missions.
Yes, but especially the Germans. I mean, it meant that they, the whole transport business is a total cock-up for the Germans. I've never quite understood why they didn't get their transport transport ace. Oh God, Fritz Morzig. Where the hell was he during Stalingrad? I can't figure that out. He doesn't seem to have been down in the Mediterranean. He certainly wasn't at Stalingrad. He was the guy who'd organised Demyansk. He knew that he'd flown in Russia as a civil pilot. He was fully familiar with this business. He was an excellent officer. Why the hell not put him in charge? But they didn't. Instead, they palmed it off minor officers, until milk is brought in. But by then, it's too damn late. It's weird. I just don't understand.
Presumably the Russians were aware of the lifeline that Air Force was creating. Did they concentrate on trying to take them out?
At Stalingrad, their initial task was to create an air blockade and then to try and take out the air bases. Actually, it was the when the armoured forces, I think it was when they sort of began to swing down behind the air bases. In Osprey, there's a book on the raid called Raid by a man named, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name, Robert Forshick, about the raid on Tatsunkaya, which is excellent work. And it shows you that this totally disrupted these two raids. Totally disrupted the main transport bases. The bases were lost, recovered, but by that time, all the supplies, the spares, they'd gone. So the Germans were having to start from scratch, and it was just, further undermined their transport effort.
It's Bob Fawcett that I talked to about Sea Lion.
He's a damn good writer. He's a really good writer.
He was good. Was Stalingrad as much a turning point for the in the air war as it was on the ground?
It was, to a degree. It was a watershed, but it didn't mean an instantly, one minute the Germans have total air superiority, then the minute the Russians. It was more subtle than that. It sort of set the pace. But the interesting thing about Stalingrad, Colonel David Glantz, the well-known writer, has said that the Zhukov's offensive of around Moscow, which was supposed to precede Stalingrad, that was more important than Stalingrad itself, Operation Mars it was. Looking at the orbats of the Soviet forces and the way Stalin assigned his reserve, his strategic air reserve, what Glantz says, that it may well be true. Because most of the air reserve didn't go down to Stalingrad. It went to the offensive near southeast of Moscow, southwest of Moscow. Then you get a situation where the Germans, they recover. And then you have Kursk. And it's after Kursk that things begin to go badly for the Luftwaffe. It's a combination of fighting on the ground. The Germans are defeated on the ground. And the Germans, the Luftwaffe is weakened. I mean, at one point, there were only, four, five, six fighters supporting the whole of Luftflotte 1 on the Leningrad front. And then things begin to decline. And also, the Germans Well, I would say they went loopy. The Air Force staff went loopy loo, because having gone for the operative, supported operative, the Air Force, the Luftwaffe increasingly becomes a tactical air support thing. I mean, you have bomber pilots flying 6 sorties a day, but they're only doing an hour. Take off, an hour, you know, 10, 15 minutes flight, drop bombs, come back again. And, you know, that isn't going to, it's like trying to stop the incoming tide with a big bag of stones.
Well, does that come back to that they can at least say, from their command point of view, I've flown X amount of sorties and some paper shuffler somewhere else says, right, he's politically on message, we can tick him off, he's fine. An obsession.
Not with the Germans. The Gestapo were always in the background, but they didn't really affect the Luftwaffe as such. Well, let's face it, Goering founded the Gestapo. No, it would be more on the Russian side. The Russians were, to say the least, unforgiving. You know, there were no errors or genuine mistakes. It was obviously whatever you did was either sabotage or you were working for the enemy, and therefore organs of state security would like to have a long talk with you. I mean, every unit had its security officer. He usually did the debriefing, and again, you watched him like a hawk. This was a guy, you know, he could put you and your entire family in a gulag like that.
That's something else you mentioned. You never went into great detail in the book, but the aircraft design gulag. I hadn't realised such places existed because it.
Oh, there's only one.
I presumed that all gulags were, the, you know, almost like hard labour camps, and I presume it's hard labour, but of a very different type.
Yes, it was not so much hard labour as soft labour, but you were imprisoned, you had no contact with the outside world, and you worked on whatever the state assigned you. Funnily enough, Tupolev was put into one of these gulags, but he wasn't. But only 3 or 4 years later was he then charged and found guilty of spying for the French. He'd gone to Paris to the Paris Air Show, I think, in 1935, and this was the reason that the MKVD decided he'd been spying for the French, and also the fact that since he was in a gulag, obviously he must have been guilty. Yeah, the NKVD attitude was, "You're guilty. We'll just find out what of." That sounds cynical, but it's true.
I find it incredible that you've got your, I don't know if he's Russia's top aircraft designer, he's certainly one of the most well-known internationally, and you're not almost treating him like a rock star and hoping to get him to produce stuff. You're actually whipping him along in a gulag.
He produced one of 3 brand new designs for the Soviet Air Force during the war. And this aircraft, the Tupolev 2, incidentally, some of them were shot down fighting American carrier aircraft in 1950. These aircraft, Stalin once, twice, I think, stopped production of them because he was disturbed because they took so long to produce and were consuming materials. And he later reproved the aircraft, the Soviet air production commissar, saying that you should have denounced me for my mistake. Yes, Comrade Stalin. You know, yes, I'll denounce you, Comrade Stalin. Yeah, of course. That'll be fun. Yes. But he actually said that. You wonder whether he had this weird sense of humour. Well, yeah, he did, actually, but there we are.
You didn't really want to test it in case you got on the wrong side. He didn't take it right. you mentioned before about the Luftwaffe doing strange things. Something else that I thought peculiar was, and I guess this is more towards the end of, you know, middle to the end of the war, they keep withdrawing forces to send them to other theatres, and it becomes firefighting with them, and they're a bit schizophrenic on where they actually need them.
Yeah. Well, the point is that the Germans had always felt that they lost the First World War because they were fighting on multiple fronts. The Luftwaffe became the first arm to fight multiple fronts. And, you know, you have limited resources and you're basically robbing Peter to pay Paul. I mentioned one example of a bomber unit which was pulled out of the Ukraine, July, August, sent to northern Italy, sits around there for about a week, then doesn't do a single operational sortie, and then goes back to the Eastern Front. You know, these were the problems that they were sending. There was some logic to it, but the problem was that whenever there was a crisis, immediately planes were, resources were sent to meet that crisis. And, you know, since there were few resources, you know, it's a bit like people talking about cuts in local government in Britain today. It's the same sort of thing. You have to rob Peter to pay Paul. And this is what the Luftwaffe was having to do.
Well, obviously, but by the time we get to the end of the war, I mean, there's just too many bushfires. Is the problem now with the Luftwaffe? You've got this idea of wonderful, I love this phrase, penny packets. They're just using penny packets, which becomes worthless to them, and they're just whittled and frittered away.
Yes, exactly. That was the problem. Penny packets with very little in the way of, if you like, they were clipped coins because they had little fuel and supplies. And, you know, you still have Luftflotten, which are little, only a handful of aircraft they can put into the sky. It's amazing that they just kept on fighting, but, you know, it was trying to keep the Russians as far back as possible.
Well, that's got us to the end of the war. Let's leave it there. Thank you. Edward's book, Air War Over the Steppes, The Air Campaigns on the Eastern Front, 1941-45, from Osprey, is available now, and I'll put a link on the website. For those who support the show via Patreon, there's an extra 19 minutes available of my chat with Edward. To become a patron of the show, go to patreon.com/WW2podcast. By contributing a dollar or two a month, you'll help grow the show and hopefully help me to make it better for everyone. Well, that's it for this episode. Next time, I'm talking to Mark DeSantis and we're looking at the Rhine crossings in 1945. I'm Angus Wallace, and thanks for listening.